This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 7th of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we're asking, what is indie? Is it an attitude? Is it a way of doing business, or is it making it look like you're anti-business? Is it a way of sticking up a finger at the man? Is indie the counterculture, or has indie become just a trendily branded part of corporate culture that likes to hide its origins? Or is it just good old devil-may-care creativity by cool cats that have struck out on their own? Is indie just an idea? We'll be using a triple-tined tuning fork to spear our three lines of inquiry. We'll inspect indie films with Little White Lies, David Jenkins. You know the sort of thing. Not big studio pictures, but tight, moody, one-off things. We'll also, of course, talk indie music, perhaps what everyone thinks about when they think about indie, experimental stuff, or just skinny boys with a mop of hair, a half-tuned guitar, and a good idea. Here's Will Hodgkinson with The Skinny.
It wasn't passive, you know, and I think that's the real key of indie. It's encouraging the fan to do something themselves.
And we'll report from seemingly the most indie city in the world, that's Portland, Oregon, home of indie music, indie films, indie breweries and coffee roasteries, indie magazines and God knows what else. So, what is indie? Find out on this week's edition of Culture with Robert Bound. Welcome to this Indie-tastic show then, where, in order to answer the question, what is indie, we look first at film. Indie filmmaking is synonymous with both a funding model, films paid for by independent producers, and a style, making pictures that big studios couldn't, wouldn't, or didn't make. Think Sex, Lies, and Videotape, or Clerks, or anything by the Coen brothers. Quentin Tarantino is also a sort of shorthand for big-time, small-time indie. To delve into the genre, or is it a genre? First, we welcome David Jenkins from indie film magazine Little White Lies.
It's one of those terms now that when I get reviews from critics in and I'm sort of subbing them and proofing them, the term does crop up quite a bit as a sort of quite a vague descriptor of a type of movie,
yeah.
Which is, you know, I guess a sort of vague suggestion of a type rather than something that's very finite. And I often sort of take it out because I think it's such a nebulous term now. It just doesn't really say anything anymore. Like, it's not, I guess in the 90s, when people talked about indie movies, it was kind of obvious what they were talking about.
Yeah.
And actually within the industry, it was a term to describe a specific type of movies. Like when you have box office analysis, people talked about, you know, the studio movies and the indie movies. And now the term that people tend to use is speciality.
So that just sounds like pornography.
I know, it does, doesn't it? It's slightly... Yeah, off
top shelf or under the counter.
Indeed.
So maybe there's a suggestion that the movie marketplace talks about these films in a different way to fans and even movie writers like yourself. That indie, in one sense, is about distribution and how a film is made and who puts up the money for it and how it gets distributed. And on the other hand, it's a suggestion of genre and type and the kind of stuff that might or might not happen in a film. So action movies, we tend to think, aren't indie, but character studies are more indie. Perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to use an example from the 90s, you know, you had a film like Whit Stillman's Metropolitan.
Tom is the only guy I've ever liked in my whole life. I'm not going to forget about him because of some apparent inconsistency.
Which is a comedy from the early 90s, and it's about what he describes as the haute bourgeoisie, which are like these preppy New Yorkers, and they're talking about going to debutante balls and things like that. And it's very kind of in the shadow of F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, you watch the film and you'd be hard pressed to sort of describe it as an indie because it sort of suggests a certain thing about the film. Whereas a film like Richard Linklater's Suburbia...
Nothing ever changes, man. 50 years from now, we're all going to be dead, and there'll be new people standing here, drinking beer, eating pizza, bitching and moaning about the price of Oreos, and they won't even know we were ever here.
Which is about a bunch of guys in baggy jeans in a parking lot shouting at each other. It's all about counterculture and Generation X. I mean, that was made by a studio, but that feels like an indie movie. So, I mean, you have these really weird kind of... blurring lines between the definition. And I think one of the hangovers of the term is it is a, I think it's a sort of shorthand for cool.
Yeah, right.
It's an indie movie. It's cool. You know, it's Reservoir Dogs. It's a movie with dark glasses on, you know?
Yeah, right.
And I guess you have these, I mean, there's an annual event called the BIFFAs, which is the British Independent Film Awards. Last year, for instance, in the Best Picture category, you had The Imitation Game, which is the big Hollywood Benedict Cumberbatch film about Alan Turing. And it basically was sort of daisy chaining along all the award circuit up to the Oscars. And I think a lot of people felt, you know, even if this is indie in some kind of technical way, should we really be lumping it in with that term? You know, should this be that our kind of definition of what an indie film is?
Well, that's an interesting thing, is that there is always a question of sort of an artistic and intellectual snobbery involved in indie, whether it's music or whether it's movies, especially those two forms of art, it seems, are very sort of tied up in an in crowd and kind of getting the references and kind of allowing people into a circle. Mm. How much is that sort of part of it? Because if a movie, a very successful movie and an awarded movie and an Oscar nominated movie like The Imitation Game with a big star in it, if that can't be seen to be indie because it's kind of letting that indiness down, then what is the state of indie?
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, there are certain directors from the 90s who were the kind of big, you know, people like Spike Lee or Hal Hartley.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see their kind of transition to what they're doing now. Is in, you know, back then they were making indie movies which were independently financed, and now they're kind of making these movies that are funded by Kickstarter and things like that, which is, I guess, the same thing. But
is that not deeply indie?
Well, that's so indie that it's kind of, you know, it transcends indie, I guess. But but it's interesting because whereas the indie movies from the 90s, they had a certain sort of professional sheen to them, and you know, there was almost like they had to work in the marketplace by stealth almost. Whereas these Kickstarter movies, they're so kind of, they're small, and you know, the filmmakers can do anything they want with them. You know, they can be quite transgressive and very anti what the demands of the marketplace are. And they are, I mean, I guess they are technically indie films, but you'd even be hard pressed to sort of use the term there. That's why I guess coming back to the idea that the term doesn't really have any relevance anymore, because I just think nothing is truly independent. I mean, I guess those films are more kind of auteurist films.
Did you make one of these game videotapes?
Yes, I did.
Okay, I'm recording. Tell me your name.
Anne Bishop Mullaney.
Can you tell an indie movie a mile away without having to wait for the end of the credits at the end of the movie to see who funded it, who distributed it, etc.?
I think you probably can, yeah. I mean, it's the rise of sort of digital media as well. I guess this comes alongside something like Kickstarter in this sort of economic side. If you're talking about aesthetics, when people started to use digital video cameras, that in itself, I think, changed what the definition of indie would be. Because I still think that when you talk about indie cinema, there is a sort of certain prestige to it. Even something like Sex, Lies and Videotape had kind of stars in it. But I guess, you know, movies became democratized. There's, you know, more movies being made now than ever. And there's a movie that's just come out in the US, and I think it's coming out in the UK in December, called Tangerine.
Hey, Alexandra, come here. Listen, have you seen Cinderella?
Looks like someone has a crush.
Which is a guy has made a movie with an iPhone, and it's been widely distributed. It was at Sundance. It got rave reviews. And in all intents and purposes, it's a kind of mainstream title. But everything about it is kind of indie, niche, other. And yeah, so I don't know. It's, as I say, it's a word that I don't think really, you know, to use it is saying so much and so little at the same time.
So at the end of that, we've kind of decided that an indie film wears dark glasses.
Yes.
But it kind of is such a movable feast that it's not necessarily helpful.
It's like The Invisible Man.
It's a bit like The Invisible Man.
It's the dark glasses, but nothing underneath.
A perfect way to end it. David Jenkins from Little White Lies, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Girl, calm the fuck down. It's not that serious.
I will go with you under one condition. You must promise me that there's not going to be any drama.
I promise.
Look at me in my eyes and promise.
I promise no drama, Alexandra.
One place where indie seems to thrive is Portland, Oregon. The city has a plethora of independent businesses, food trucks, magazines, publishers, record labels, bands. The list goes on. So what is it about Portland that breeds so much indie? And how is creativity encouraged in the city? Our reporter, Melanie Sevchenko, heads into town to find out.
Cascade Record Pressing is a recently opened vinyl pressing plant on the outskirts of Portland. co-founder and CEO Mark Rainey takes me on a tour. Rainey says they launched the plant due to an overwhelming demand for vinyl records in the music industry. It's gotten to the point where established pressing plants are backlogged and overworked. Portland was the obvious place to open a new one.
It's got a strong, you know, independent music scene that's been established for decades. There's never been a plant here. You know, we felt strongly that there was going to be a community of local artists, local labels that would embrace this operation and, you know, see it as a community resource. And thankfully, so far, those suspicions have been proven true.
Cascade is not interested in chasing down the major accounts. Instead, they're choosing to work with the people on their side of the business. Indie, self-release, DIY, and local. And in Portland, that's abundant.
The times I'd visited up here over the years, I mean, it just seemed like indie land, where almost every business seemed like a standalone mom and pop. I mean, good luck trying to find a franchise anywhere.
It's true that Portland only has two Fortune 500 companies, Nike being one of them. Most of its tree-lined streets are filled with independent boutiques that often specialize in unique, locally made products.
People can go to Portland and expect to find weird, quirky specialty shops.
Emily Jannings is the store manager of Screaming Sky, a self-titled gift gallery and art shop. Located in one of Portland's arts districts, Screaming Sky sells prints and limited edition collectible toys designed by the artists themselves. 90% of the artists featured at Screaming Sky are Portland-based, and locals are given incentive to shop in their neighborhoods with programs like Supportland, a network that gives rewards for shopping local. Here, the small business movement is on the rise, and for residents, that means the cityscape is in constant flux.
Just on one street, like what can change in a month is kind of astounding to me. There's just always new restaurants to check out, always new shops.
Screaming Sky has only one location, yet several businesses around it have begun to franchise, like the ice cream shop beside it or the burger joint across the street, which was bought by Hooters, America's scantily clad sports bar. And one of Portland's most beloved donut shops, Blue Star Donuts, is heading to Tokyo.
What we're seeing now is that the first chance these people that started these little businesses have to sell out, they're doing it. And they're absolutely doing it. And so what does that say about our real indie cred?
Martin Sismar is the arts and culture editor at the Willamette Week, Portland's alternative weekly newspaper. Sismar reminds us that Portland is not too different than a lot of mid-sized cities in America. The story goes, artists move to a lackluster city because it's cheap. Eventually, it becomes more attractive and people with money move in. Since 2008, rents have increased over 60% in Portland, and many have been forced to move further out. Yet still, even with its creeping cost of living, compared to its high quality of life, Portland offers more value than other major West Coast cities, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle amongst them.
At some point, Portland will no longer be a great value, and then people will start looking at something else. But I think we're still a little ways away from that, much to the chagrin of the nativists.
The nativists are those who want to keep Portland weird, as the city's slogan demands. They're still married to the Portland of the 90s, the heydays of the indie scene. But even those scenes, like music and film, have been outsized in people's minds, says Sismar.
And I think what we're seeing in Portland now that also is freaking out natives is that those little scenes, while they're still here, they're also bigger scenes. Like we now have a hip hop scene. So I think that what's happening is that it's diversifying from being this little boutique indie burg to being a city that has a little bit more of a worldly influence.
There's a ton of camaraderie here among musicians, you know, where drummer will play in five bands and the guitar player will play in several bands and everyone, you know, they put shows together.
Jose Medellis is a Portland-based musician and one third of 1939 Ensemble, an instrumental group that consists of drums, vibraphone, and trumpet. His lengthy roster of those he's played and recorded with includes The Breeders, Ben Harper, Joey Ramone, and Modest Mouse.
It seems like the promoters really try to help out local bands, which is really great. So that is really intriguing, you know, to have a environment that's inviting and where everyone has that kind of we're in this together.
Medellis has also had success as a store owner with Revival Drum Shop. It's where people go when they think about buying drums.
revival has stayed alive and thriving because people really understand and back the integrity that we have as a shop and what we're trying to do. And I think the same goes with 1939 Ensemble.
It comes down to a community, says Medelis, where Portlanders will pay to see several local bands a night, no matter what the genre.
You can wear what you want, you can kind of do what you want, and it's okay. Go to whatever show you want. That's the beauty of Portland. It's really independent. I think there's still a lot of independent thinking people here. You know, I meet them every day. And that's why there's so many cool businesses and cool bands.
And that's something which newcomer Mark Rainey at Cascade Record Pressing can agree with.
I definitely have still the impression of the city being one that, you know, if you come here with a good idea, you know, be it a bar or a restaurant or a product, and put it forward and make it available to the people who live here, you know, if it's something they can use and something they approve of, they will embrace it and support it.
For Monocle in Portland, I'm Melanie Savchenko.
Thanks, Melanie. After the break, we'll be separating our libertines from our Jesus and Mary chains with rock and pop critic for The Times, Will Hodgkinson.
We should have breakfast together, and lunch, and coffee, and cake, and a forced beer, or even an Aperol Spritz at sunset. And we know just the perfect spot. Come and join us at our London cafe that's just around the corner from our Midori HQ and also close to the Monocle shop. While you have a great flat white made with all-press coffee, you'll no doubt bump into one of our team and get to hear all the latest from the Monocle world. You can also pick up the latest issue of the magazine. Oh, and we also have space for hosting private lunches and events too. Join us at 18 Chiltern Street in London and also at our outpost in the Hankyu Men's Department Store in Tokyo. We look forward to seeing you.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, and today we're asking, what is indie? We'll now hear about indie music. What is it? You think you know, don't you? The Velvet Underground, Patti Smith, The Libertines, guitars, attitude, a certain dark glasses at night notion of cool, the underground, the underdog. Again, we wonder if indie music is a style of guitar-y pop music, or if it's just music of any type put out by a non-major label. What of the auteur in all of this? Chief rock and pop critic of The Times here in London, Will Hodgkinson, is an armed and ready indie aficionado.
Indie as a genre, as opposed to sort of definition, suggests guitars. It suggests a certain triumph of ideas over ability. You know, indie is not about 28-minute guitar solos in 10 different time signatures. It's about a good idea and a certain style, a certain sensibility, a certain attitude. And really, that's, for me, that in a way, it is a definition. I think indie is a concept where if you've got a good idea, it doesn't really matter how good you are as a musician, you can get that idea across. And the heroes of indie, which were pre-indie, would be bands like the Velvet Underground, who were accomplished, but their music wasn't about showing this incredible complexity. It was about the idea, you know, so the idea of having a viola against feedback, or the idea of having a very, very sweet love song next to a song where you're singing about heroin. I think that's the essence of indie.
What does it mean in terms of labels? I mean, there are indie heroes in terms of labels as well. And is that, are indie labels about a kind of aesthetic as well, or are they about not being owned by a major conglomeration like an EMI or a Warner? How do you define an indie label?
An indie label in its pure form is, first of all, it is independent, although often once they got successful, labels like Creation did have money coming in. But it's independent. It's generally started up by an enthusiast rather than a businessman. And it tends to have a sensibility. So the idea with indie, you know, on Warner Brothers, who knows what you're going to get? But the idea is that on Creation Records, which is the really important indie label, most important of all.
And this was the label started in the late 80s by Alan McGee. It was famously the home of Jesus and Mary Chain.
Initially, Jesus and Mary Chain, of course, it went on to sign Oasis. But it was started in the early 80s with bands like Felt, the Weather Prophets, the Jasmine Minx, Biff Bang Pow, some of whom have been completely forgotten, some of whom are remembered. But the thing was with Creation, and I was just kind of coming of age when Creation was around, you felt that even if you didn't necessarily like every single record, there was going to be something interesting about it. It was a bit like John Peel. You know, John Peel was the great indie DJ in a way because you may not like everything he played, but it always had something. You trusted him. And there was a certain judgment going on. It's taste over commercial considerations. And I think indie became, in its pure form, it was independent record labels and a kind of independent ethos. It later, and I'd say Oasis was the turning point, it became a genre. And then indie bands were like the Stereophonics were an indie band who were signed to a major label who were clearly very, very commercially ambitious and really were just doing rock, but it was guitar-based. And so the term, in a way, got dissolved and diluted. But in its pure form, indie belongs on an independent label and the artist has at least, hopefully, an independent ethos.
And I wonder, I mean, in this sort of in the strife and turmoil that there has been much stories in the music industry in the last 5, 7, 10 years, whether indie has sort of come back, whether it's not, and whether or not because of the downfall of the major labels or their stranglehold on how we buy music and how many people buy music, whether indie's kind of come back and whether it is the same genre in its sort of comeback form.
You see a label like Domino Records. That's been a very successful label. Their turning point was signing Franz Ferdinand. Before then, they had a lot of very cool American artists like Will Oldham and Royal Trucks and all these bands who at most sold a couple of thousand records but were considered very cool. Franz Ferdinand and later the Arctic Monkeys went to Domino because of the image it had built up. And so now Domino is a very, very healthy label and successful, and it's got some of the biggest... I mean, the Arctic Monkeys are still one of the biggest bands in the world, but they've remained independent. So it can work, and I think what happened now is that because music is essentially... If you want to hear a band, you can just hear it on the internet. You don't have to pay anything, whereas when, you know, 20 years ago, you'd have to hunt them down. What's happened is it's become the indie idea of the niche interest thing has sort of built up again. For me, when I was growing up, I felt very much that it was incredibly exciting to be able to see this band and then they'd be in the bar afterwards because they weren't that big, didn't have any money, you know.
looking to be bought a drink.
Yeah, hopefully. And they were wearing clothes from jumble sales and charity shops. They weren't wearing things that you could never afford. In a way, it was a bit purer than punk because punk was quite contrived in many ways, especially by Malcolm McLaren and, you know, wearing Vivian Westwood. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But you could go along to the Falcon on Camden on a Friday night and Bobby Gillespie would be leaning by the bar wearing a pair of, you know, this is prior to big fame with Primal Scream, you know, he'd be standing there in a pair of sort of ripped drain pipes, which you could get from Camden Market for a tenner. You know, the whole thing was not... There was not a big distance between an indie fan and an indie label owner and an indie fanzine producer. And the whole thing was actually rather creative. It very much encouraged you to do something, even if it's just go to the gig and sort of talk to people. But it wasn't passive, you know, and I think that's the real key of indie. It's encouraging the fan to do something themselves. I'll bite my thigh.
And if we take indie to mean how music is distributed, the people that actually own the labels that this music is put out on, and the attitude of the musicians and artists involved as well, if we take it back to its kind of roots that we were talking about, Will, maybe it's not skinny boys with guitars, maybe it's hip-hop, maybe it's dance music, maybe it is actually singer-songwriters but doing it in a different way. Has the genre changed with the way that the music industry works?
In a way, it hasn't. I think indie, I mean, really, indie should mean anything, shouldn't it? If you look at grime, you know, UK hip-hop, it's totally indie because for most...
It's done in bedrooms.
It's kids in flats, but, you know, because now you can make this music on a computer. That's very indie. But I don't think most people would call that indie. It's like everything. It's like you could folk music or heavy metal or anything. It doesn't really bear scrutiny, although we kind of know what it is.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, for me, the most indie thing of all was this great book, which is called The Scene in Between, and it was a series of photographs from the 80s of it's basically just indie fashion. And so it's all these kids who've just got the most ridiculous bowl cuts, or they're sort of dressed like kind of five-year-olds with learning difficulties. And, you know, there's this whole thing of indie where it's a bit rubbish and you're a bit, you know, you're kind of the kid that gets picked on. And instead of trying to sort of, you know, taking out a subscription to, you know, Rustler magazine and doing a, you know, a bodybuilding course, you celebrate it. And, you know, you celebrate the weediness and it becomes a kind of anarchic and rather sort of defiant approach. So yeah, I think we know what indie is. You know, it's still floppy fringes and winkle pickers.
And just finally, do we still hate it when indie bands become big? We'll probably think of the same thing when we talk about films in this show, actually. You know, when either an actor or a director blows up, and suddenly you have to pretend you never liked them in the first place because they're on heavy rotation on Radio 1, for example. That still is the case.
Two things happen, and I'll use a personal example. When the Jesus and Mary Chain got big, which was actually, the classic album was called Psycho Candy, but the really big one was the next one, which was far more commercial and not so good. And they actually had a hit on Top of the Pops with a song called April Skies. And I was at school, and on one level, I felt like my football team had won. You know, the unlikely heroes had come through, and it was great. But at the same time, there's a girl who I was kind of going out with at the time who liked Wham and Pepsi and Shirley and whatever. And she came in one day singing April Skies, and I thought, oh, this is really terrible.
This could have been your perfect moment, but
yes,
it wasn't.
No, it wasn't my perfect moment. So that's what I think. We all do that, don't we? We all have the thing that we love, which on one level we're really pleased because you root for it, and on the other, it's taken away from you personally and it's now out into the world.
Will Hodgkinson, as ever, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that was interesting, wasn't it? What is indie? Do we know now? Do you know what? I'm not sure that we do. It's an elusive little swine, isn't it? We've heard that in the film world, it's a troublesome term that makes critics go all skew-whiff. It's less a set of principles than a scene, perhaps. If you go to the Sundance Film Festival, you'll receive a pretty indie film experience, though. For that, I will vouch. In music, indie is an attitude and much more of a genre. Although hip-hop and dance music might be released on independent labels, we've learnt that really, indie music is guitars, smudged makeup, and a whole ton of attitude. As for Portland, well, it sounds nice, but maybe a tea bit nauseating to me. Just saying. But it's a noble thing, I think, to look after yourself and put your own name above the door. DIY, kind of. So what is indie? It's a way of holding yourself. It's cool, it's more of a nerd than a jock, but a savvy one. Indie is life through dark glasses, man. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was my very own Sid and Nancy, Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.